편지 초.
Hello, welcome to Auti Talk, a brand new monthly podcast all about autism and the autistic spectrum. I'm your host, Louise Crooms. I was diagnosed with an autistic spectrum disorder a couple of years ago, and I've got children on the spectrum. In today's episode, I'll be talking to Andy, a lovely man who talks openly about his childhood and why he decided in his 60s to seek a diagnosis. He's right in the process of being diagnosed right now. Sensory problems can be a massive issue on the spectrum, and Jo talks to me about why she absolutely cannot stand buses. I will have a rant about something that annoys me, which I know you will agree with most definitely. Jed will be here, an autism specialist nurse, talking about the diagnostic process and why people get diagnosed later in life. I'm delighted that Jed will be with me for the whole of series one. There'll be six episodes. This is the first one. It's called Diagnosis. My first guest is Andy, who is a full-time dad and a qualified plumber, which is quite handy if I need any of my pipes looking at. Whereabouts are you in the process of being diagnosed, Andy?
It's a kind of a preliminary interview which eliminate people who are probably not on the spectrum. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so this is a screening first interview.
Yeah.
Just to make this clear to people who are not based in the UK, this is based on the NHS. So we have this initial interview to make sure that we haven't got people who potentially may not have autism. So it's a first screening test that they have. So there is a possibility that you might not have autism, Andy. Do you think that's possible?
I think it's highly, highly unlikely. From lifelong events, I think it's extremely unlikely that, Louise.
Right. And how did your initial screening go? Did they give you an indication from that?
Well, it was such a relief to meet this person in the first place. Can I say his name?
Yeah.
Jed. He's the autistic, adult autistic nurse, if you like, for Tameside.
And we're going to hear from Jed a little bit later on because he's going to describe the diagnostic criteria.
Yeah,
so I'll just let you know that.
And it was such a relief to hear from him in the first place. Indeed, on the initial phone call I made to him, I just broke down in floods of tears and I couldn't get my words out. And with relief that now, after such a long, long time, I had a chance to sort of get to find out, was I likely to be diagnosed with autism? I'm convinced I am autistic. And it's ever since the birth of our daughter, really, that I've wondered that. I'd identified so many things that she was doing. And I thought to myself, she's so like me. As a child, I was doing that and I was doing this. And there's so many examples, I mean. But it was just so clear. It hit me just absolutely clearly as day. And before that, I'd already had some dealings with neighbours' children who did have autism. And there were little clues and little cogs were turning in my own mind about that. So basically that's how the process began, if you like.
What was it in the children that you saw living next door to you that you thought, hang on, that rings a bell?
Right, well, obviously I'll be sort of confidential here, but ordering things and being away from the social gaze, minimal eye contact. Let's put it this way. As an adult, who I believe, I'll just call myself autistic for now, right? I know I've not been officially diagnosed, Louise.
You can diagnose yourself. You can be self-diagnosed.
Sure. Yeah. As an adult, you learn all these different social cues, if you like, which are, if you're autistic, you're only masking. You're pretending, you're masquerading, really. And I think, depending on your upbringing, I mean, I had wonderful parents, don't get me wrong, but there were no PlayStations back then or what. I mean, I'm 61. So, you know, it was times were very, very different then. I had a very good childhood, but I just know that all my sort of friends of that time, all used to do is go out and play football, and then they'd go out and congregate somewhere else, and I'd just come in and read books. I read books on all kinds, absolutely anything. The very first book I read, I was 8 and a half, and it, don't laugh at this, it was Dracula, Bram Stoker. I'll never forget it, and I couldn't put the thing down. Now, that intensity of reading at that age, I mean, I'm not a brilliant reader, but to be absolutely gobsmacked by such a, what is it, a remarkable story in itself, Dracula, at that age, I was just, you know, looking back on it now, I'm thinking, how on earth did I do that? And I'd go on a few years later than that, and I'd be reading things about relativity and science, and instead, where all my mates would go and play football, I'd go and play some football, but I'd spend all my days in the summer holiday at the library. I'd just sit in the library for maybe 2 or 3 hours and then bring a load of books home.
Tell me about Dracula. What was it about that story?
Fascinating. The mystery, the way it's written as well, it's brilliantly written story. I get quite interested about, always have been, in that. I like fiction, that kind of fiction. But also I like things that are, you know, the factual side of things.
The true crime.
The true crime, yeah, yeah.
Now, how we met originally, Andy, would you want to explain how we actually met?
Yeah, yeah. Well, we did the post-diagnostic course, and it was for the parents of recently diagnosed autistic children. There's about 15 people, am I right? It's about 15 people on the course.
Yeah, and you were sat at one side and I was sat at the other
first day. Yeah, yeah, and it was quite a bit of a free-for-all of people chucking things in here and there. And I just looked at you and you were like sat back, as I was, just sort of waiting your turn to throw your spanner in, if you like. And then when you started speaking, I could tell, I thought, this lady's got a real insight into autism. And it was within a couple of minutes of you talking, I thought, no, I think this lady might be on the spectrum. And forgive me for saying that, won't you? But I mean, that's it.
So you had me figured out.
I had you sussed.
And then you realised you were right when I announced to everyone that I'd been
I didn't know how to react then. I thought, how do I react now? Do I feel, wow, I didn't know how to react then. And I thought, wow, that's good, I was right. And this may sound terribly disrespectful to some listeners. I bear no disrespect at all, but you can just tell. There's something you can just tell. And for me, autism is not... it's classed as a disability, isn't it? But for me, you know what? It's a gift. It's been a gift.
And why is that? Explain more about that.
Well, if you look at all the people in history, for one, I think society likes to include everybody. It likes to assimilate as many as possible, which is, in a way, it is one good thing. You know, I'm all for kind of including everybody in society. That's the ideal. But also, you have to understand that if I'm not comfortable in a certain area, or if you're not Louise, or if little Susie isn't, or little John isn't, or little Jack isn't, then they're not the ones with the problem. If society shuns them because of that, society's got the problem. And I think I've actually said that to people. You know, it's not, my child's not giving me a hard time. She's having a hard time, and that's the difference.
More from Andy a little bit later on. Sensory issues can be a real problem for people on the autistic spectrum. Jo shares now why she does not like buses.
This is Arty Talk.
So you stood at the bus stop. I've got the app, the movie app. That's never right. It always says the bus is due and then the bus doesn't come. So then it's like, well, where's this bus? Because I've got to be somewhere. Because, you know, same going to the doctors. You can't plan anything with the buses nowadays. They're always late. So then you stood at the bus stop and you get the little old dears coming up or people and you're thinking, oh, here we go. And they start talking to you and it's chit-chat rubbish. And you're thinking, oh, please go away. You know, I mean, I have strangers walk up to me in the street and tell me their issues, you know what I mean? And I'm like, oh, for God's sake, I really don't care. Just go away. What is it about me? Have I got a label on my head? So then they start talking to you at the bus stop and then you get your phone out and you pretend you're talking to somebody on the phone just so they don't speak to you. Or you have the stereotypical headphones on because, yep, we don't like to talk to people, don't like to converse. So then you get on the bus. Whew. Right, in this weather, it'll be stifling. All the windows will be shut and you'll be sat there thinking, please open the goddamn windows. Then you get the smelly people. Oh, my God, they stink. And when you've got, when you're on the spectrum, more often than not, you've got sensory processing going on, which I have. And you can smell BO from a mile off. Yeah, not good. So then you sat there thinking, please don't sit next to me on the bus, please don't sit next to me, please, please, please don't sit next to me, because you get someone sat next to you and they ran right up to you and they're touching you and they're sweaty and oh no, no, no. And then you're thinking, how am I going to get off this seat when I've got my thing, because the bus is normally full as well. And then you dread to think if the bus ever breaks down or there's a detour, because it's like, oh my God, where's it going? It's not going where I need it to go. Oh no, no, can you see? It's not good. It's really not good.
It's Arty Talk.
Thanks, Jo. Totally agree with you there. Very annoying, buses. They can be, they let you down all the time and you end up talking to people in strange ways and they really smell quite bad. I could totally agree with you. Back to Andy and his interview about how he got diagnosed, where the process he's going through. He's going to talk about how he copes in football stadiums of all places.
I lived in London and it was one of the places I stayed at. I used to work all over London and the landlady, young son had, she said, I think he's got autism. And well, I didn't know what it was at first, but the more I got talking to her, the more I began to understand what it was. And, you know, even then, cogs were turning in the background in my own mind, thinking about, well, am I just fixating on things here? But I used to do this and I used to do that. And I didn't tell anyone about it. I was working on my own. I lived in London to all intents and purposes. And that was that period of time. And I did read the odd thing. It only came into the public sort of arena mid-80s. Is that right, Louise? Is it mid-80s?
Yeah, yeah. So in the early 80s. Mm. In the early 80s, yeah. There was the first time that it appeared in the diagnostic manual for autism. Yeah. I know what you mean about meeting people and knowing something about them right away. There's sort of a feeling that you know them, that you get on with them. And I remember one moment I was in a room, in the back room of a party, and some mum came in with a little boy and said, oh, he doesn't like it in there, it's too noisy, can he sit in here? And I was like, oh, hello, a friend.
Yeah.
I had a feeling about him that maybe there was a reason that he was finding it too noisy in the other room. I didn't know anything about him or what he may or may not have had, but there was something about him. I thought, you've come to the right room.
That's it. Yeah,
sit with
yeah,
me.
Right
in
away,
here.
You know, don't you? Yeah.
We've got something in common automatically.
It's Arty Talk.
What is it that made you want to get your own diagnosis?
Going back, you know, 61 years, some people say, well, why bother? I can only answer that by saying, well, why not? It'll just put things into perspective. And, yeah, it'll make sense of what's gone before.
You found out that there was someone diagnosed in our area in the Greater Manchester area and you said, right, I'll give him a phone call. What did you say to him on that phone call?
I just said, well, like I say, I couldn't get my words out, but because it was an emotional phone call. And I just said, all my life I believed that I am autistic. Asperger's, I said, but now the terminology is autistic. They no longer use the term Asperger's. Is that not right, isn't it, Louise?
That's right, but people choose to sometimes.
Yeah, and
some people would.
So all my life I believed in Aspie, well, as long as that's kind of, as long as we've kind of officially known about it in society, I believe I've fitted into the criteria. So I sort of believe I'm Asperger's and I like a diagnosis. So Jed was brilliant. He had a long conversation on the phone and he just invited me in after a bit of a wait. But obviously, you know, there's a waiting list for an initial interview, which lasted maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours, something like that. I was just a bit of a machine gun. I was just like, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Because he said, what is it? You know, why do you think you are autistic? And that was his initial kind of comment. And
he regretted asking that question.
I think
right
that was it. He was playing catch-up with his writing pad for quite a while. I mean, I told the story about being alone in a crowd. He picked up on that right away. And he said, well, how did you feel? And like, say, when a goal was scored and people were jumping about, and how did you feel with body contact and people being right next to you? Because it was all standing. You know, there were 20,000 people in the Cup at that time. If anyone doesn't know, that's the Liverpool Cup. He used to hold 20,000 people. That's amazing. And everyone was standing. And there's a little 8 or 9 year old boy in there. That's me. And when a goal scored, it's like mayhem. You will have seen it on the old footage. It's like chaos. But I didn't mind because I kind of felt a bit uneasy, I suppose. But when I think about it, not that much. And that didn't bother me, but it bothered me to be in a crowd when it was a social thing, when like, parents went somewhere. Well, we've got to go to Auntie so-and-so. She's having a party. Oh, no. I'd be frightened. Louis is laughing. And it was real. That was a real biggie, a big, massive biggie that I'd be hyperventilating and everything. I can hyperventilate thinking about it now.
Talk.
I get the crowd thing because I became quite obsessed with the Olympics when it came to London and I went to see a few things and it's quite scary being in an arena or a stadium with lots of people in there, but you're all facing in one direction, you're all there for one reason and there's a sort of supportedness in the crowd, there's an atmosphere that you can pick up on, it's very supportive, you're all watching the same thing, you're not facing each other, you're not asked to say anything that you don't want to say, you're not forced to socialise, you can be with people in a very structured way without having to interact with them really.
They're strangers.
Yeah.
They're strangers, aren't they?
But they don't expect anything of you. They might hug you, they might jump up and down when you've scored a goal, but you want to do that as well because it's your team. You want to chat. I remember when Mo Farah had a gold. You know, you want to jump up and down and
That'd
hug
amazing,
everybody.
Yeah.
Amazing
yeah.
stuff. But the atmosphere from the auditorium, you get a lot from it, from the stadium. But you don't have to socialise with those people. You don't have to talk. So that's the difference in a crowd. It's not like you want to be with loads of people to socialise with them.
You go in there for a purpose.
You're there for a different reason. It's got a purpose. You're not even facing each other. You're facing whatever, the stadium or the pitch.
Can I just say something about that as well, which is quite interesting, actually. My own daughter, a few years ago, she wanted to go and see a Liverpool game. And obviously, she hadn't been diagnosed then. But we realised it was almost nailed on that she's autistic. So obviously, we spoke about it, my wife and I, and My son was at home then, our eldest son, he was at home. So he said, well, how about this? How about if we go? And my daughter has all the little fidget gadgets. She takes them. She takes her ear defenders. She takes her headphones, the bassy ones, the deep bassy ones, ear candy. And we go as soon as the gates open, get in there, and she can see it slowly filling up, the ground slowly filling up. So as soon as the turnstiles were open, we went in, and which is a good hour and a half, maybe more, before the kickoff, and slowly she could see exactly what was going on, the ground empty more or less, and then it filling up slowly, and she was quite comfortable with that. So that's how we dealt with that, and it really worked well.
Brilliant. I think it's a good plan.
Yeah.
Orty talk.
The third part of Andy's interview is coming up soon. There's something I really need to get off my chest first. It's time for...
It's Orty Rant.
I sit down for the first time all day and I decide to do a bit of reading. It's feeling quite quiet. Then suddenly, there's a loud noise. What's that noise? Right in my face, the noise is. Ah, I'm reading it on my phone and someone's ringing. Who rings you on your phone? You use it for reading, scouring the internet and setting your alarm. You certainly don't expect it to ring. Wait a second, what if it's something important? Hello? Oh, hello, is that Louise? Yes, speaking. Oh, yeah, I want to talk to you about the accident that you had. Well, I've not had a... Wait a minute. I know this. It's a sales call, isn't it? Yeah, sorry, I'm not interested. I put the phone down. That's the thing about phones now. No one rings you with any good news anymore. No one rings for a chat. It's not, I just called to say I love you. That doesn't happen anymore. I'm really annoyed. You see, I don't like phones anyway. They seem good on the surface. I mean, when you first had a phone in your house, it was brilliant, right? But what sort of thing constantly gets your attention and moans at you to answer right away on someone else's agenda? You see, this is what annoys me. Ring, ring, it's your mother. Ring, ring, it's your auntie. Ring, ring, buy PPI. You don't want to buy all that stuff or be moaned or be mithered. You want to talk to people when you want to talk to them, not when they want to talk to you. And then you answer the phone. It's really difficult to manage. You can't work out from the person on the other end if they're bored with you or if they're angry or if they've taken what you've said in the right way. And then you talk at the same time. Sorry, no, you go on, you go on. I know what you're going to say. Oh, I wasn't going to say anything. I just thought you weren't speaking and it gets really confusing. And then there's the silences. Who's going to fill those? Phones are a total pain. Now we carry them everywhere with us. People can ring you in the bathroom. They can ring you in your car. They can ring you at night because my phone is an alarm clock. Then you have the opposite problem. Because sometimes you do need to ring someone for some human interaction or to tell them something. You've written that text 4 or 5 times and made a mistake. And you really need to ring them now because it's getting pathetic trying to type it out. And you can't get the same thing across in an email. You want their response right away to find out what they think. So you don't have to go back and forth again and again. But every time I ring my friends, no one ever answers. So if you need me, leave a message after the tone. I won't get it because I don't know how to access my answer machine. You've reached the answer machine of Louise Crooms. I'm really glad I managed to get that off my chest. I do find phones quite annoying. They're useful in their own way. Back to the interview with Andy. Now we're going to be talking about everything from rocket fuel to weird textures that he doesn't like, all the way through to the worst disco on earth. What is the other things that you were asked in your screening interview?
You know, did you play sport or did you play football? I did play some football and I did have friends, but only a few friends, to be honest with you. And I just didn't fit in. I just seemed to be awkward about everything. I would end up being a bit of a loner. And I did do sports, quite a good swimmer actually. I used to train swimming. I used to love swimming because even though you're swimming in a club and there's you coached. I swam with a club in Liverpool. It was nice, just swimming. All you can hear is the drum, drum, drum of the water, and that's it. It's great. There's, other than the coach bawling at you, there's nothing else. You know what I mean? It doesn't involve heavy-duty conversations or anything like that. So,
what did you think about the water? What did the water feel like?
Lovely. Loved it. There were certain things. That was something else. You prompted me there, Louise. Jed said, what about textures? Are there any textures that you don't or didn't like then or you don't like now? I said, yeah, there's one thing I never could stand, and that was soil. I can't stand touching soil. It's horrible. Sand's okay, but soil, I don't know what it is.
What about wet sand?
That's fine.
Interesting.
Interesting. And also, he said, what about other things that irritate you or have irritated you? And I spoke about labels on clothing. And it's usually, sometimes it can be the neck, but it's mostly the side label on a T-shirt or a shirt. That has to come off right away. If it's irritating me, it's got to come off right away. You know, my family said to me, but Dad, it's an Adidas shirt or it's a Nike shirt. You know, you can't be doing it. I can, it's off, and that's it.
Get rid of it.
Get rid of it.
I'm not having it near me.
You've now depreciated its value. Just get short of it.
Whatever. Let's cut it off. It's like a dagger.
Yeah.
To the ribs.
And also, there was one. He said, what about, have you got any sensitive areas about yourself? You know, about you, is anywhere you can't be touched, so you don't like being touched? And I said, yeah, I've always hated being touched on the inner forearm, from the wrist to the elbow, inside. I can't stand being touched there. It's like an electric shock. I don't know what it is. It's horrible.
I'm going to try it now. it's horrible.
No.
I know what you mean. It's very sensitive. And did he, what was his response as you're pouring your heart out to this man? What was he doing? Was he just writing things down?
Kind of, we had a bit of a laugh. For the first time, I felt I could reveal all with impunity, because it was just, I wasn't going to be judged. He was just writing down, and he nodded his head, and then he'd ask, well, is that just, what about clothing touching you there? I said, well, certain cloth, if it's a certain grade of cotton, I can't wear it. Yeah, I just cannot tolerate it. So I've had a shirt bought for me at maybe Christmas or something. Lovely shirt, put it on and it's that cotton I don't like. I can't wear it.
Arty talk.
When you finished your interview with Jed, what did he say to you? Did he give you any indication of how well you'd done on your test?
Yeah, I said I've passed.
A for autistic.
We had a laugh. He said that, right. He said, I think from everything that you've spoken about, that we've spoken about, I think certainly you do want further, you know, to do the full, it's called a DISCO assessment, isn't
it? It's the worst party.
Yeah. I wouldn't talk to anybody else. It's only somebody, obviously my wife or yourself or our mutual friend Joe, who could talk to about now, because there's nobody else who's kind of tuned in, who I know is tuned in to, who gets what I'm on about. And that's the only time I can talk about it, and talk to Jed, certainly. And other people who've helped Meg, my daughter, and other people who have helped my daughter, I can talk to them as well, because they get it as well.
And the interview, the DISCO,
mm-hmm.
It has a thing like diagnostic. You see, it all stands for something, but I don't know what it is. We should work out what that is.
Yeah,
it takes between 2 hours and 6 hours.
Does it?
Yeah, I think mine was about 4. I went for 4. We should break the record. What's the longest DISCO ever done?
God.
Or the shortest? I think you're looking at about an hour and a half to 2 hours minimum.
Yeah.
And then depending on depending on what it is?
I know there's some quite bizarre questions asked.
You'll have to tell me about them. Although I know because I've been asked them.
Yeah. There's not much information out there about the disco.
No, I'll tell you.
For obvious reasons.
I'll tell you one moment from me. Jed asked me if I had a monotone voice, and we spent about 5 minutes trying to work out if I did. It turns out I don't. But I didn't know.
That's interesting, yeah.
Because not everyone has the same symptoms. You have
Somebody's described my voice as... I answered the lad I used to work with once. He said he was... I phoned him up and he was out, and his wife answered the phone, and I said, "I heard so-and-so, it's Andy here." I said, "Oh, I can recognise your dulcet tones anyway."
Charming.
Yeah. So I thought, right, okay.
Right, I'll take you down on the disco for that one. Thank you very much, Andy. It's been brilliant.
Yeah, it's been
Thanks
a pleasure.
Amazing.
Been a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thanks to Andy for his honesty and being so brilliant on the podcast. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Now I'm going to talk to Jed, who's an autism nurse, who's going to tell us more about the diagnostic process for adults. And if you've got a child on the autistic spectrum, remember this would be quite useful for you as well, because autistic children do become autistic adults.
It's Jed.
My name's Jed Ratchford. I'm an autism specialist nurse.
What does that involve, Jed?
It mainly means we do the diagnosis for adults in Tameside and Glossop.
And do you, I mean, why, is there a need? I'm guessing the answer is yes.
We certainly seem to have a lot of people that are referring themselves or being referred at the moment. I think because there's a better understanding now of autism. There's more people in the public eye with autism. There's more children getting diagnosed, therefore their parents or their parents' friends are now recognising their own traits.
And are you finding that's from having a child and them getting diagnosed first?
Not exclusively, but it's quite a common theme that people's children are getting diagnosed and they're recognising the traits in themselves. Sometimes it's the other way around, but that's probably more common. But then there's lots of people that just have suddenly got to a point in life where people have mentioned it to themselves or they've done their own research and started to think about the possibility that they might be autistic.
What is it like across the UK in terms of diagnosis? Is it similar?
The tests are probably the same two tests. So most people, we do a disco test.
The worst party in your life, this disco.
It's not as exciting as it sounds. There's also an ADOS test. So they're slightly different. I suppose the disco test is, or the disco assessment, is basically me asking hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of questions to the person themselves, possibly to their parents if they want to be involved, or if the person wants to be involved, maybe to their partner as well. So they're the two main diagnostic tools. The way you get to use those tools, or the way you get to see somebody is probably different. So in Tameside, people can refer straight to us, which is really good because it cuts out the possibility of having to go to your GP and your GP not quite understanding. In other boroughs, you might have to go to your GP. So that adds a bit of a barrier, which is why we don't like not letting self-referrals happen.
I benefited hugely from avoiding the GP. I knew the GP wouldn't... Well, I didn't know, but I assumed that the GP wouldn't notice that I was different. I think they'd probably say, "On you go, Louise, there's nothing to see here." So I self-referred directly. I thought that would be easier.
Yeah, and it's not that all GPs like that, but some GPs have said that. And also some people have been told by doctors, you're in your 20s or 30s or 40s or 50s now, why worry about it? Whereas someone might be in the 60s and it still could be a really important thing. It could still help them to make sense of things they've struggled with all their life and help them to explain themselves to people in the future. I don't think it's up to GPs or me to decide who should get diagnosis or not.
What sort of things do you ask as a matter of interest? I mean, I know, but I'd like other people to know.
So I was in the disco, it's sort of...
I bet you can recite it now, can't you?
Probably, if I start at the beginning, I probably could. There's a lot of questions, as you know, and some of the sections aren't always relevant for everybody. So it starts off with someone's first couple of years. If you're doing it with an adult and the parents aren't involved, you kind of skip that unless somebody knows that they had certain traits in the first couple of years. Even if the parents involved, it's really hard to remember how your baby was when they were 1 and 0. The main areas it concentrates are sensory issues, which comes up towards the end, looking at the need for routine and structure and struggling with sort of breaks in routine or needing to maintain your environment and sort of keep things in the right place and finding it really stressful and things get moved about. There's sections about social interaction. Not that people that are autistic can't have friends, but it's sort of the challenges that people face throughout their life. So it could be there was times in their life when someone was really isolated and really struggled to understand the social conventions and how do I start talking to this person and what should I talk about and how do I chat to my classmates at school and that kind of thing. So the other things it sort of talks about quite a lot is the play people did when they were children. So stereotypically, autistic children don't do much imaginative play, or if they do, it's a little bit later than other kids, or it's a bit more structured than other kids. It's not quite as, not that autistic people can't be really creative and imaginative, but the play where you sort of pretending Action Man's going off an adventure or pretending your doll's real and you're talking to it, most autistic kids didn't do that because it doesn't actually make sense. It's not logical.
And when you're going sort of through asking all of these questions, do you feel that you need to use a certain amount of judgment yourself to try and unpick? Because someone's going back, they might be in their 60s, and trying to work out what they did. How much judgment do you offer with that?
I suppose when we're doing a DISCO assessment, we're asking someone a question, they're giving us an answer. We're kind of judging, for want of a better word, how unusual that experience was for somebody. So if you said to anyone in the world, do you like really loud noises? Most people would say, I don't like really loud noises. But just because of the way someone describes it or the intensity of how much pain certain noises can cause people or repetitive noises or high-pitched noises, then we sort of, our judgment would be, was that a completely normal reaction to noises or is it slightly hypersensitive or is this person really sensitive to noise? So that's sort of the judgment part. And part of it's what somebody says, part of it's how somebody says it, to be honest. You can sometimes just see from the face someone pulls when you're discussing something that they're not just saying, oh, noises slightly annoy me. It's certain noises are actually appalling to me.
Have you ever opened the door to someone and known immediately that they have autism? Have you never known that?
Sometimes when we meet people for the initial assessment, at the end of it, we'll be dead honest and say, I'm not quite sure, but we're going to do the DISCO. Sometimes, especially if somebody's done the research themselves and somebody can just come and sometimes an initial assessment is just somebody telling you why they think they're autistic and they've done the research themselves. And at the end of that, you're really clear, of course, that person's autistic. We'll do the diagnostic test. Sometimes it doesn't seem pointless, but you kind of, you're just confirming to the person what they already know. And just because I've got certain letters after my name, that counts for some reason. And I suppose there are times when I'll meet someone and literally just from the first few minutes, I think I can recognise quite a lot of traits. But life isn't that simple. Otherwise, you know, my job would be just opening the door to somebody and saying hello and then giving them a diagnosis.
And that being the end of it. Have you met many people who you've looked at and you thought, no way, no way, and then it turns out they do have autism or they're on the spectrum?
Yeah. So it's especially in the initial assessment, quite often at the very start, somebody's just got really good social skills and they've sort of mastered things they found really difficult. And for the first 5 or 10 minutes, you're sort of trying to work out where these autistic traits are. But then when you're asking quite direct questions, that's where it becomes a bit more apparent that somebody's struggling. And there's been people that I've known for other reasons and I've not even thought about them being autistic. And then I've had a referral and I've done a diagnosis with them. And I might spend ages with that person. But because I wasn't asking them really direct questions about social interaction or communication, I didn't realise that they had any of those issues.
I think I often think that it's the core thing about it. I mean, I play very imaginatively and so do my children, and this is what we do. But I still know at core what drives it is that difficulty. And also I
cope with a lot of high anxiety all of the time. And it was more or less going, oh, it's the anxiety bits. It's not that I can't do it. I can do all of these things, but it's the amount of stress and anxiety it takes me to do them. But I've just got used to that sort of high level of anxiety.
Yeah, and I think I do meet some people who say something very similar and actually got to a point in their life when they kind of realise, oh, not everyone else is feeling this level of anxiety. It's socialising afterwards. I can do it and I might even be quite good at it. But afterwards, I'm absolutely wiped out and completely knackered for the rest of the day, possibly the day after. And some people get to a certain point where they suddenly discover no one else is, well, most people aren't feeling like that. So how come I'm completely exhausted? And it's because it's harder work, usually, for most autistic people than it is for your average person.
Autie Talk.
I can't believe it. We've reached the end of the very first episode of Autie Talk. Thank you so much for listening. And special thanks to my guest, Andy, Joe and Jed, who have been brilliant and honest and just fantastic. Andy will be back next month to talk about the diagnosis of his daughter Meg and the issues they had with that. Jed will be back to talk about the different words we have for autism and why it's so very confusing at times. The podcast will be back in a month's time, which means the next podcast, episode 2, will be out on the 1st of March. It always comes out on the first Friday of the month, so it'll be the 1st of March. If you would like to find out more in the meantime, go to my website, autietalk.com. You'll find some blog posts there and you can contact me on the contact form if you have any suggestions for guests and future ideas for episodes that you would like to hear from me. Don't forget to review the podcast so we can share the message far and wide. I will see you next month.